Pleased to be with you this morning. Delighted to get a chance to visit the state of Oregon and the Halsey community. Been hearing over the years little snatches and was glad to have this opportunity. So if someone's glad that I came, I'm glad that I was invited. This week we're going to be following a theme in the addresses each morning that is based on the verses that were already read from 1 Kings 3, especially intensively based on verses 7 and 9. And the first one for this morning is from verse 7, 1 Kings 3, 7, and where in Solomon's prayer for wisdom he said, "I am but a little child." Now the program title was slightly altered. I don't know if that was intentional or not, but I'm going to keep the word little in there as I discuss it this morning. We were hearing in the devotions about growing in wisdom and growing in understanding. And that's beautiful to see somebody getting wiser, getting more capable of handling his responsibilities. But the opposite is equally ugly, equally despicable, to see someone regressing, going backwards. I had a great uncle. Some of you may have read about him in church history or something. His name was J. Irvin Lehman. And he was widely used as a teacher at EMC and gave addresses and held classes many places, and his many of his writings and so on were appreciated. And late in life, one of the brethren in our community asked him for permission to reproduce some of his work, and he refused because he no longer believed it. And that's regrettable. That's equally as distressing and despicable as what we were hearing in the devotions is beautiful. The loss of wisdom is tragic. So this prayer of wisdom is going to sort of guide our discussion this week in the morning topics. And Solomon began his prayer by recounting how God had been so good to his father. And then he asked God to be good to him. But he introduced himself by saying, "I am but a little child." Now, we're familiar with Matthew 18, in which Jesus says that we ought to become as little children. But he says there we ought to become as a little child. And we often say, well, that means that we should not have an ego, and we should be willing to forgive and forget the way children do. And so on. But Solomon's saying something different here. He's not saying you should have the mindset of a little child. He says, "I am that. I am but a little child." What do you think he meant? Well, James Usher's chronology would say that Solomon was 18 years old at the time of this transition from his father's kingship to his. And that's young enough, I know. And yet, in chapter 2, right before this, his father had said, "You're a man of wisdom." He called him a man and said he had wisdom. And it's not as if Solomon was a stranger to the royal court. He had been in a kingly court, and so it wasn't as if he felt lost there. What did he mean when he said, "I am but a little child," or literally, "I am a little boy"? Well, I did some research on this word child. It's the same Hebrew word that is used in the chapter of David and Goliath. When David came to King Saul before he went out to Goliath, and Saul said, "Thou art but a youth." He didn't think what he was saying was much. And it's the same word that is used later when he came close to Goliath, and Goliath looked around to see who this was and disdained him because he was but a youth. It's the same word. And the Hebrew word means a boy from the age of infancy to adolescence. But because Solomon said, "I'm a little boy," I think he was using the lower age bracket, and we need to think of the range of maybe ages 4 to 10 or something like that. What did he mean when he said, I'm a youngster, I'm a little boy? Well, I don't know, because I wasn't Solomon. I'm not there in his mind. But this is what I came to the conclusion of. When great responsibility descends upon a person who is at least somewhat mentally mature, as I think Solomon was, when great responsibility descends on a person like that, he just bows down before the awareness of his inadequacy. And he knows that even if other people think he's mature, and even if other people see this or that good about him, he knows full well that he doesn't often act his age. And he knows that sometimes he does become discouraged. Sometimes he is impatient. He's maybe fearful. He's perhaps careless or something else. And he knows that. He knows he has to regain his bearings with the Lord now and then, and how quickly he can lose those bearings. And yet his experience tells him he has enough experience, enough mental maturity to know that if he's been given great responsibility, he's going to be asked for great accountability. And there are going to be great expectations from other people. And the mismatch of all that's going to be expected of him, on the one hand, and his knowledge of his humanity, on the other hand, makes him bow down, and he begins to realize his true posture as being one of a little child, down but looking up. If I had a four-year-old here standing beside me, and he wanted to look up here at my written material, he might have to stand on his tiptoes and then hardly get his eyes over the edge. And that's the posture Solomon knew he was in. He was down but looking up. Because he was feeling short of stature in relation to the largeness of what was facing him. You know how it is with little children. They are down, but they're continually looking up at their parents' faces, looking up above the countertop, trying to see over the edges of things. And similarly, mature people who have been laden with a lot of responsibility and cry out, I'm but a little child, they don't mean I can't do anything, I don't have any potential, but what they mean is, I am much smaller than all the largeness that's surrounding me. But I want to be able to grow into it. Children want to grow. That's one of their big mental aspirations. They want to grow. A child wants to grow, and so this person who says, I am but a little child, means I am way down here, but I do want to grow into what is expected. I want to handle what I can. When President Franklin Roosevelt died unexpectedly at the beginning of his fourth term, the vice president was Harry Truman, and the country was in wartime, and so all those wartime responsibilities just came down on him. And the day after he took the oath of office, he told some newsmen at the White House, boys, if you ever pray, pray for me now. I don't know whether you fellows ever had a load of hay fall on you, and he had a country background, but when they told me yesterday what had happened, I felt like the moon, the stars, and all the planets had fallen on me. Now, he wasn't saying I don't have any abilities, but he was saying I feel so small looking up into the largeness that has come upon me. When Abraham Lincoln was leaving Springfield, Illinois to go east for his inauguration, right as the nation was dividing, he said this to the people at Springfield before he took the train. Here I have lived a quarter of a century, and I have passed from a young to an old man. Here my children have been born and one is buried. I now leave, not knowing when or whether ever I may return, with a task before me greater than that which rested upon Washington. which of course was when the nation was beginning. Now it was dividing, and he saw that as even greater. Without the assistance of that divine being who ever attended him, I cannot succeed. With that assistance, I cannot fail. So when men are mature, at least partially, as I have said, they bow under the realization of the demands of responsibility being greater than their adequacy. But if they are not only mature, but they're also godly, then they have an additional awareness that makes them bow. And that is that they are entering into great accountability before the Lord and taking part in things that are consequential for eternity. None of us here have ever had the governance of a nation come upon us as Solomon or Abraham Lincoln or Harry Truman did. And yet the nations that they were called to govern were temporal. But the call that comes to us as a worker in the kingdom, whether it's a teacher or a parent or minister, whoever, that work has eternal echoes. So when Christian workers respond to calls to take up parenting, teaching, ministering, whatever way it may be, they feel inadequacy, as Solomon did, and they feel accountability. So now, what is it particularly about school teaching that makes you feel and know that you are little in relation to the magnitude of your work? Well, the first thing I'd like to think about is the diversity of people whom you will serve. And I'd like to look at a variety of people groups that we serve in our teaching. First of all, student diversity. Now, true, I have been teaching in 30 years, but I am still meeting people types that I had never met before. You will never come to the end of student variety, which also means you'll never come to the end of student challenges. Just last year, for the first, I had an autistic child in my classroom, or at least that was the first that any had been diagnosed as autistic. But he was high-end autistic, and so he could fit in a classroom a lot better than would be possible sometimes. And last year, I also had a combination I'm not sure I ever had before, and that was a child that had OCD, as well as somewhat of a clownish and naughty bent. And it was all together. So I'm still seeing new things. Many of my teaching years, I've also been the principal at the school where I was. I've asked recently to have someone else take up that work. But teachers would come to me frequently and say, I'm not faulting them for asking this, but it struck me over and over how this was. They'd come to me and say, "What do you do with a student who?" And then reel off the problem, as if there was sort of a one-to-one correspondence. You know, here's the list of problems. Now, which of these is it, A, B, C, or D that you do for that? Well, they didn't mean it to sound that way, but it almost gave me the impression that I should be ready to hand out an answer, and I wasn't. Each situation has a need for some analysis. Rubber stamp solutions don't work in dealing with the diversity of people. You can't just pick it up and put it down, and then that's done. And if we are called to be one of the people to dole out the efforts of dealing with problems, we feel very small in our efforts. Further, the teacher will encounter diversity of parents. And they also continually challenge us. Some parents are very, you know what I mean, by taciturn. They just don't say much. They're Calvin Coolidge. They don't talk. Some are blunt. On the other hand, you might get multiple phone calls from some. Some seem to be sort of reserved. Some are open and warm. Some seem to espouse the school cause wholeheartedly, and they're nice to talk to, but some you can tell there's a lack of enthusiasm for this or that aspect of school, and there will be diversity. But each one is important, and each one counts in the life of his child, and it's our ability to work with them as a team that matters. So we can't ignore it. We can't resent it. We also have board member diversity. And these board members come in all stripes. I taught under a board member who never, ever visited my classroom. Even though I had one or more of his children over a period of 17 years. Now, he was not on the board all that time, but he never, that I know of, visited my classroom. But then I had a board member that frequently brought warm circles around my heart because he just seemed to feel as my servant. He just would show up before school, sometimes before I was even there. He'd ask if anything was needed. If you started presenting a need of something that you thought you needed a purchase or a repair or whatever, you could just sort of tell it was almost already getting started, getting finished. And he was just very nice to work with. I'll never forget that board member. I had a treasurer that sometimes wouldn't get my paycheck to me on time. And sometimes when he did send it, he would send it with one of his children in an unsealed envelope. We have quite a diversity to work with. And I am to submit and respect the authority of all these types. So we cry, I am but a little child. I'm still down here peering over the edge of this table trying to see what goes on in the world of adults who are supposed to know how to relate well to other people. Well, that's one thing. And of course, we have diversities of teachers, and board members have diversities of teachers to work with, too. So there's diversity everywhere here. But I'd like to go on to another division of the topic and look at another thing that makes us feel little. Not feel little, be little. The volume of answers that we're called on to provide. And maybe some of you that are getting ready for your first year don't know about this volume yet, but I'll introduce you to them. First of all, some of the answers you'll need are answers for behavioral needs. You knew that. The teacher knows he's going to be on call for defiant students' needs, the needs of disorganized students, unmotivated ones, sly ones, shy ones, many more kinds. And he's not going to necessarily receive a warning before the situation just blooms up and needs an answer. And it's going to have to, it's supposed to come from him. The volume of answers. Another thing besides behavioral needs is answers for procedural and classroom management things. The teacher realizes that it will be I who sets the tone, the pace, the procedures for either a smoothly humming classroom or a room with disorder and a poor learning environment. And where am I going to get those answers, and who should I speak with? And if I do try what he suggested, will it be successful? And we feel questions coming thicker than answers. So the volume of answers. We also will need answers for academic materials. Did you ever hear of this acronym? MIGO. It stands for My Eyes Glaze Over. And I think that perhaps this area might give some new teachers a bit of apprehension as they think about how much they have forgotten since they were in school, or how hard an individual subject here or there was for them when they were in school, or the wide range of grades they're going to need to be prepared for, the wide range of subjects they'll be responsible to be knowledgeable in, and the little child feeling comes on strong. Another area of answers that we know we'll need to provide are, at least for maybe the brethren, we'll need answers for income needs. Frequently the issue may come up to married men who are teaching as to how I'm supposed to both provide this service of teaching and provide for the needs of my family. And if I hardly have enough time to prepare for school as it is, how am I supposed to juggle more work that provides more income? And that requires some type of answer. Another area of answers we need to provide is, especially this might fit with teachers that have taught a while, or if they are filling the role of a principal, they are going to be asked to give advice for other people's needs. Teachers will ask the principal many questions, and he might feel responsible to help, but know himself to be a little child. And sometimes parents may even come to home and school, parent-teacher, whatever meetings you call them, whatever you call them, and they might be working with the same issues at home that you are, and maybe think that you even have some suggestions for them. It's ideal if teachers have the support of their home communities in both the community's attitude and the provision of financial resources, so that they have the time and ability to do some study into pedagogical matters, so that they have some things to try. But regardless of whether they get that support or not, they still often feel like little children when they're asked how a child should be helped. But these little child feelings are really good, because the Bible says that out of the mouth of babes and sucklings, God has ordained strength. If I feel capable to advise, I probably am not, right? But when I am weak, then am I strong, the scripture says. A third area that should produce the little child feeling, we have had the need for the volume of answers and the diversity of people. The third one I'd like to mention is the scrutiny under which a teacher will live. That can make us aware of our littleness. Teachers will be talked about, generally. Their words, they'll be quoted. Their actions. Why do I remember a story from maybe 30 years ago being told of a young man teacher who actually tried to demonstrate running up the classroom wall in front of his students? I don't know why he did that. If it was justified, I would want to admit that, but I would have a hard time realizing any way to justify that. But they'll be talked about, and people will remember what teachers do, the things they've said, how they dress, their families. They'll be talked about. Their failings at school will be distributed by the students, and students aren't necessarily committed to accuracy. And students will have minds and perspectives that may not be very mature, and yet they're going to talk. Teachers are under scrutiny. Teachers will be evaluated on their finances. After all, the community is their employer, so they have their antennae out when the teacher reaches for his wallet. And under this scrutiny, the teacher might tend to shrivel or shrink or maybe even shriek, "I am but a little child. I can't handle this." Another thing that makes a teacher know he's little is his need to divide his time among many demands. Time can be so tyrannical. It just keeps going. Now, I have never in my life as a teacher really heard a definitive, conclusive answer on how to resolve this issue. It's addressed at teachers' meetings. But do you know Mark Twain's famous quote about the weather? He said, "Everybody talks about it, but nobody does anything about it." Well, it's not quite that way with this issue. People have tried to be helpful, but I have never really found a conclusive help for dividing up time successfully. So it makes us feel little. It makes us know we're little. We have home and family needs that need attention, and don't need just peripheral attention, they need major attention. But maybe we are still running to catch up, getting an understanding of the material we're teaching at school, and that takes time. And we need time to read and browse for personal inspiration to enrich our teaching. And then for some reasons, it seems that teachers are frequently also asked to help with other areas of church work, such as writing or editing or teaching Sunday school. And those can be valuable things for them as well, but how's the time to be divided? That makes teachers know they're little. Trying to see over the edge. So we have plenty of reasons to know ourselves to be little. Now what? Well, I have several, only three ideas as answers, and this would be something that I would say could be enlarged upon more in question and answer time if you would have some more suggestions. I'm giving only three. What we can do about this reality of being so small in the face of so much largeness. Well, first of all, we need to allow that stance, that posture, to affect our style of decision making. I'd like you to if you have your Bible, to look at 1 Kings 3, verse 7. Right after Solomon declared himself but a little child, he said, "I know not how to go out or come in." When we understand that that is truly the way we are, not just how we feel, but that's how we are, we don't know how to go out or come in, it will affect our style of decision making. Sometimes I take a good while to think things over. Sometimes I don't take time when I should. But I am slowly learning that after all these years that it pays not to do things hurriedly when dealing with other people and the problems that arise in dealing with other people. Sometimes I don't even know what is out or in. So how would I know whether to go out or come in? So our awareness of being a little child makes our decision-making style become, first, prayer dependent. We don't feel like a bag full of answers. We know what we are in relation to the largeness, and we're going to need to pray about it. It makes our decision-making style become weight dependent. That's the W-A-I-T kind. So that we have time for second thoughts, for cooling of emotions, for memories to come back. And I often felt like a bit of a poor excuse when teachers would come to me as principal and say, "What do you do if?" And I didn't really feel as if I had anything to say right then, or not much. But I don't think we should feel that it undercuts our authority as fathers, principals, whoever, board members. When you don't have an answer rolling off your tongue as soon as the question comes to you, I don't think we should take it that way. I think it is a sign of maturity to ponder, as long as the pondering happens in a timely manner. It shouldn't take a month to do it. And our decision-making style will become not only prayer-dependent and weight-dependent, but also consultation-dependent. We need to ask other people sometimes, "Am I thinking rightly about this? Is this how you would see it?" And so this awareness of being but a little child causes us to decide carefully, which affects our style of decision making. The second thing I would like to mention is that what we do about our awareness as little children is that we remind ourselves of our position in the midst. Verse 8a says, "And thy servant is in the midst of thy people." Now, you know, if you know geography of Palestine, that Jerusalem was not geographically in the midst. But Solomon knew that Jerusalem was the capital. Their people converged for worship, for government. He was in the midst. We must remind ourselves of our position in the midst and accept the accountability that goes with being an example. We might wish we could throw that off. We don't like it. Why do they have to look at me any more than him? Well, we're in the midst. We are called to be there. And we need to just accept the extra accountability that goes with that. Public servants cannot afford to misbehave or routinely malfunction. They should not try stunts like running up the classroom wall. If they are called to be a comedian, that's not in the classroom, they just can't do that. Faces are turned toward them, ears are tuned to them, and so what we need to accept is, what we need to do is just resign to this greater level of accountability. People are going to look at us more. They're going to talk about us more. They're going to see us more and roll it around. And what we are needs to be something that will be acceptable. We can't please everybody, no, but we need to resign ourselves to greater levels of accountability. Just accept it. We also need to recognize that servants are not necessarily treated fairly. Servants of the church are not in a position to say, well, that's not fair. You can't talk that way to me. With so many people grouped around us who are in the midst, we're going to be given some conflicting advice. We're going to be given some poor advice. And we're going to maybe be given some nasty comments that should not come from Christian brethren, but they do. But servants are not necessarily going to be treated fairly. We need to recognize that. But thirdly, on the positive side, I think we who are in the midst also need to be glad to have joy that we have been entrusted with the influence for good. We have been given the privilege to work with children's lives. So what about our being down, looking up, our littleness and our smallness in comparison to the largeness? Well, first of all, I said it needs to affect our style of decision-making. Secondly, we remind ourselves of our position in the midst and accept the extra accountability. And thirdly, we need to continually expose ourselves to the paragon, the unequaled word, the unequaled paragon of God's word, as well as the many delightful avenues of knowledge that God has put into our world, so that we are always delighted in learning. If we are down looking up, the only way to come up is to learn. And we need to constantly learn from the best of all books, the Bible, as well as the many other delightful avenues. And I'm just going to enumerate some that came to me, some avenues besides the Word. One would be the avenue of how learning occurs. If we want to understand the people that we're trying to help with learning, we need to have some understanding of how learning occurs, that the science of pedagogy is what that is. What do various age groups, what's typical of various age groups? Why does he act as if he never hears me? Well, maybe he's not an auditory learner. Maybe he's a kinesthetic learner. Maybe he's a visual learner. Maybe he's a tactile learner. Do you know about those four, the KAVT? Kinesthetic, audio, visual, and tactile. Some people learn best if they can touch it, wind it, rub it. Some people can work best with something they can maneuver, and it produces muscular action that registers better. That's what we're doing when we teach them air writing and penmanship, so that they can train their gross motor muscles, and then it finally gets down into the finer control muscles. Some people learn best by hearing, some best by seeing. So some things, sometimes we write on the board, sometimes we talk, sometimes we chant. We need to study how learning occurs if we want to grow into the largeness. Secondly, we need to do some learning about learning disabilities because they are on the rise. Thirdly, we need to learn more about interpersonal relationships. What does make things go well with other people, little people? Fourth, we need to do some learning, and we can't do all this at once, but we just need to have it on our list to work at. Church history and polity. Now, maybe some of you sisters don't think that's for you. You might be amazed how much interesting material there is about people relationships and the background of why you are where you are, church history and church polity. The many branches of science, some like one branch, some like another, some maybe profess to like none, but you should find some branch. Learning about wildflowers and birds is science. Language history and language peculiarities. So that in spelling class, when your students are discouraged about this lesson that has so many IE and EI words, you can tell them a little bit why it is that way or something about it. Geography, local geography, and geography on the wider scale. Skills, crafts, hobbies, so that when you hear that this child is doing this, that you have at least a little idea what he's talking about. Fellow parents, fellow teachers, we just need to take some joy in how God has designed it to work in our lives to show us our true sizes. And not feel negative about being small, but realize that's of God's design. To make us small as we grow up into his work. I'd like to conclude each of the addresses this week with a little poem that I've tried to prepare for coordinating with the topic. And I've titled this one, Childing Up. Now that's a coined word. There is no word like childing. But we often talk about growing up. But remember, we're growing up, but we're always going to be a child. A child size. A teacher you are, but a child, eager to live and to grow, willing to say you are small, yet wanting to see and to know. Blessed are the scholars enrolled daily to sit at the feet of teachers whose vistas, though small, grow more and more nearly complete.